Hello, welcome to this latest edition of Jibe Talking, the Volvo Sailing Podcast. A few technical gremlins meant some of you may have missed our last programme. Apologies for that, but we are now back on track. Okay, in the podcast this time we have British sailing boss Stephen Park with 500 days exactly to go to the start of the 2012 Olympics. Thomas Colville describes a near disaster on board Sodebo as he chases down the solo circumnavigation record. Brian Thompson tells us about his failed Jules Verne attempt aboard Banque Populaire. And we finally catch up with skipper Guido Belgiorno Netti after he and the Transfusion crew take the Rolex World Far 40s. We missed him last time, but better late than never. Okay, without further ado, let's move on to the Volvo Sailing Podcast news headlines. Thomas Colville overturns a 1,300-mile deficit and is now on schedule to break Francis Joyon's round-the-world record. Disaster strikes Groupe Bell and Mirabeau in the Barcelona World Race. Meanwhile, at the front of the fleet, Verbeek Paprec continues to lead from Mapfre. Francis Guillaume Florent and Pascal Rombo win the Stars Bacardi Cup in Miami by a single point, while Puma, powered by Berg Propulsion, announces its team for the Volvo Ocean Race. No place for veteran Jerry Kirby, but there is for his son Rome. We'll be talking to him next time. Okay, now it's over to Matt Sheehan talking to Scandia Team GBR boss Stephen Park as the Olympics closes in.
Well, I'm with Stephen Park, who's the RYA Olympic manager, familiar to a lot of people who followed Olympic sailing. Now, Stephen, Tuesday is a big day for the Olympics.
Yeah, 500 days to go, and it's going to be a big celebration, I think, in London. But really just it's the beginning for us of the preparation year for the Olympic selection trials and really for getting people into the right place so that they can have the right preparation and run into the games itself in 500 days.
And it's also a big day for anybody who wants to go to the Olympics, isn't it? Because I think the ticket process starts on that Tuesday as well.
Yeah, tickets go on sale, or at least the ballot opens, so you can log on to London 2012. Onto their website, and you can start bidding for tickets. And when I say bidding, it's actually a ballot, so you just have to register. It's not that it's a bidding as if like eBay or whatever, but you log on and you put your name down for any of the tickets for any of the sports that you want to go to, and the public ballot starts. And of course, for this Games, there is going to actually be some ticketing and some spectating for sailing down in Weymouth and Portland. So that's a big step forward for our sport.
How do you think that is going to change things? That's the first time that sailing has had ticketing, or Olympic sailing has had ticketing. I mean, what are spectators going to see, and how do you think it might change things in the future?
Well, actually, in China, in Beijing in 2008, we did have, there was some unofficial ticketing that was run by the local authority, where they effectively opened the breakwater that was immediately adjacent to the race area that, for the medal races that they were holding the final races on. And they had about 8,000 people a day on the breakwater, they said. It certainly felt like that. And I think the big change is that, you know, the racing is getting closer to shore. The races are being shorter. More emphasis being put on the final race, particularly through this concept called the medal race that was introduced for the last Olympic Games with the International Sailing Federation. And really trying to create a bit more of an atmosphere and a spectator event for those final days. Certainly for the spectators, and you know, from the experiences that we had in China, it is a great thrill to be on that breakwater and be able to be following the racing, albeit that it's still a reasonable distance away, but everybody watching through binoculars, and you can tell as the various countries are lined up in the different spectating areas as to who's winning or not winning at any particular time. And then, of course, as they come back in from the racing areas, the safety boats sort of guide all the sailing boats to sail along past the spectator area, and of course everyone's given the appropriate cheer as the new medalists come past. So it really rounds off what's, for those that are interested in watching sailing, a fantastic day for the spectator, but also a great thrill for the sailors themselves.
And do you think this would be seen as a model for the future? Do you think we're on the verge of seeing Olympic or high-profile dinghy sailing changing in the future, or is this just a one-off for the Olympics?
I think that there's, you know, the medal racing concept is now being delivered at all the World Cup regattas. I think there's quite a lot of discussion going on at the moment about the development of the World Cup and trying to make that a more commercial entity and to make it a more spectator-friendly entity. And a lot of that is about looking to the future in terms of how the games might look in sort of 8-12 years' time. And yeah, there is quite a lot of movement to look at, you know, sort of what people might consider more exciting short format championship podium type racing, as various people call it. Having said that, there is a strong contingent within the sport that feel that that is taking away from the traditional aspects of the sport, and it's putting a lot more emphasis on individual, what that final race, rather than being the best performance over a period of time. You know, normally we would have a series where we'd have a week's races every day, and either 11 races normally or 16 in the 49er, so most class 11 races, and you'd drop your worst score and count your best 10, so it's the best sailor that week rather than the best sailor in just one particular race. And I think that of course is about trying to recognise that there is still a degree of luck involved in our sport, because so many factors out with the control of the sailor themselves. So there are people that feel that that is detracting from the sport, and it does make the more traditional boats and the keel boats more difficult sometimes in those formats. But on the other side, there's a lot of people who think that it's very interesting, it's exciting, it will bring a new, younger, more athletic audience to the sport, and therefore be more desirable and be more competitive in terms of competing for people's times by comparison with the sort of other developing high participation sports that are coming to the fore now within the Olympic arena.
We'll be having more from Stephen in our next podcast. Okay, now thanks to Wind Report and the Sodebo website, we have Thomas Colville talking us through the moment he realised his crash box was damaged in his solo round the world record attempt.
I was sitting on port side with about 25 study knots of wind, reaching nearly upwind, with about 3 or 4 meters of waves on my side, on my port side, and suddenly I just a little shock, but it was very, very little shock, and it was, I was even not very scared about it, and I had many of it before I left, and before, but suddenly I looked at it outside, and I could see 4 meters, huge water spray coming from the bow, from the starboard bow, and I understood immediately that the little shock I heard or I felt before was traumatic, because it just damaged the bow, and it was potentially the reason of stopping the adventure now, and so I have such a cry and such a I just shout, and I was it was too much. I couldn't understand, and I couldn't accept to just by just for it was even not a mistake, because by yourself you can't look at it, and you can't look at what happened every minute or every actually when I look at the sea after me, it was clear that I was touching it was some waves just on the surface, and but I'm sure that even the waves doesn't really feel it. I just touch it, and I'm sure that it, and so I took a picture, and I was like it was like a nightmare, because I had that problem in 3 years ago. The first time I tried that record, and I have to stop and go back to Cape Town. We tried to find a solution that we could have two bow, actually. We've got a hydrodynamic, nice, fair bow, But inside we've got a structural bow. Can accept exactly what happened yesterday. So I can touch something. I can lose that first bow and keep going with the structural one. So there is no water coming in the floaters. Psychologically, I need to go and I need to finish and I need to go to that finish line. So I just make the boat go back to my course and decide to keep going and decide to even to try to have the same speed. And the good news is from now to the finish, I will probably be only 2 days on the port side, and all the 10 other days or the 12 other days are going to be on starboard side. So I won't be too much affected by that damage on the starboard floaters. So, because it's a very very tough experience physically. But I think I'm feeling good.
Thanks again to Windreport and Sodebo. Okay, while one French campaign looks on track for round-the-world glory, another's licking its wounds after a failure, I'm afraid. Banque Populaire forced to abandon her campaign for the Jules Verne trophy. We ask the lone Brit on board, Brian Thompson, what went wrong?
Well, we've got 13 days into our round-the-world record. We were down into the Southern Ocean already, and lining up to get south of Cape Town, and middle of the night, completely black night, cloudy, no moon. I was actually on the helm doing very steady 35 to 40 knots, around 37 knots was the target speed, and suddenly there was a collision with something. Thought there was some weed or something around the keel. Back down, started going off again, but there was a tremendous vibration from the daggerboard. And in the morning, we flew the main hull and saw that more than half the daggerboard had actually disappeared. So from that point, we knew we were very much hampered to get the round the world record.
Now, given the amount of preparation you need to do to get a campaign like this, and looking for weather windows and everything else, what was the mood like aboard the boat when you realised that this particular challenge was over?
Oh, we were very disappointed. There was some people really, really very sad about it. You know, so much work, as you say, has gone into it. You know, boat was first conceived in 2005. You know, it's a boat that takes 2 years to build, and it's been being prepared for three years, and you don't get many chances to actually go on the record like this, because it's such a competitive record. It's like getting, you know, the pole position and qualifying in Formula One. You don't, you need nobody on the track, and you need dry track and no accidents and lots of rubber on the track. So for us, that means having really great weather conditions and the boat in good shape. And the previous year, the boat had waited all year and hadn't even been able to go because the weather hadn't cooperated. And this year, we'd waited 3 months for the right weather. So to get going and then have an accident like that is really disheartening, because it's something you can turn around and do the next week. So it's going to be November till we can restart. So everyone was disappointed. But the good thing was, you know, once we, you know, agonized and made the decision, then suddenly there was lots of fine French food came out. So we actually had a bit of a party. Said, okay, we're on our way home. You know, all these treats that we were saving up for Cape Horn. I didn't know about all the pâté and fine cheese, Calvados, rum, whiskey. Suddenly came out. So that was a nice thing to do. To say, okay, let's enjoy the trip home and not, you know, not worry about what might happen. And all these records are actually now, even historically, before they became so hard to break, historically there's been only a 33% success rate. So, you know, we had one of our chances. So if we don't get it next time, we'll get it. We'll get it the third time for sure. But I'm pretty confident next year we'll have a good crack at it.
Now, Brian, I have to ask, the vast majority of that crew were French. You're the Englishman aboard. How did you get selected for the team, if you like?
Yeah, well, it was offered by chance, really. The whole team is French, except myself and Juan Vila, the navigator, who's Spanish, won the Volvo with Ilbrook. But his French is excellent, and he went to actually a French school and is totally fluent in French. So I was probably definitely the worst French speaker on the boat, but it's got a lot better. And I've actually taught some of the French some choice English sailing phrases as well, which will come in handy for their future sailing. But it was really a little bit by accident. It was in Cowes. I was at Spinlock, and they were doing a technical sort of conference for some of the French teams, IMOCA teams, and the Grand Prix Volvo team, and also the Multihull teams. And they invited me along because I knew some of the people already. And one of the guys there was Kevin Escoffier, who's a sort of head engineer guy at Banque Populaire, and they said they're looking for experienced people for the round the world, and would I be interested? So I think just because I knew Kevin from doing the Transat Jacques Vabre when he did it with his father on Creps Wahoo, we knew each other, and perhaps they hadn't thought of actually Anglo people being particularly multi-hull with multi-hull experience, but I'm probably the one with the most experience now, and they've done two round the world non-stops on Cheyenne and Doha 2006, so I was reasonably well qualified, so it worked out really well. I did some training with them, sailed to the Med and in the Med and back, so did some miles and got to know the boat and the team, and we gelled really well, so I'm on for the next round the world, which should start standby from the 1st of November this year.
Well, Brian, we wish you every success on the next one, and as you say, there's a 1 in 3 chance, so hopefully that will come up. Just a final thought, there is a Frenchman, of course, out on the water at the moment, making a solo attempt on the solo round the world record, Thomas Colville on Sidibo. Are you keeping half an eye on events there?
Oh, I'm definitely keeping more than half an eye on that. It's an incredible challenge to do it solo. And when we left from Brest, his boat was sitting there, and he almost left on the same weather window, and in fact left a week later. So we were down there in Brest with him, and I think having gone, around the world in a big multi-hull and having done the Vendée, I really got an idea of what he's up against for the record, for the stress he's under and the time pressure. Well, the stress of sailing the boat and then the time pressure of the record is tremendous, and I've been tracking it closely, and he's been behind all the way, and finally now off Brazil he's got actually ahead of the record, so I've got my fingers crossed he can get it. This will be his third time of trying, and following that 33% success ratio, hopefully this third time is a charm for him.
And finally, we catch up with Rolex World Far 40 winner Guido Belgiorno Netti. We did try and get hold of him for the last podcast, but we have finally made it. And of course, his Transfusion boat pulled off a dramatic win in Australia. He tells us how.
Well, I mean, what a race. I mean, who would have thought that we firstly would be up there in the first place? It was a strong fleet. I think there were at least, in my guess, 5 to 7 boats who could have won it, and I think the guys who ended up slipping back from us had a bit of bad luck and just didn't quite get their race organised or their races organised as well as they'd hoped. But notwithstanding, we were lucky enough to be still within striking distance of Neroni on the last day. We had been leading the day before, and on the final day we were about 1 point behind. So we started the day on the basis that, you know, we were still in striking distance and we just had to sail good races and generally overall stay in front of them. Now, that second last race of the day did not start very well for us. We didn't get a good start and we ended up pretty well slipping back and to the point where we were ninth or tenth around the top mark on the first lap, and Moroni was winning the race. They were leading and they had a very solid lead, and so I must admit I thought that we were not looking so good at that stage, and we didn't say anything to each other as a team. We just hunkered down and got on with the job, and I'm very pleased to say that we were able to recover from ninth at the top mark to fifth at the bottom mark on the end of the first full lap, and then we were second at the top mark again on the way down to the finish, which and we held that position. So Moroni finished first and we finished second, and we were now I think 3 points behind them, and although it would come down to the last race, we still felt that we had a reasonable chance. So we kept all the spectators on edge, Guy. It was quite an interesting scenario, and of course, not to mention ourselves, we were then spending, you know, thinking through what did we have to do in the last race, and we just said we've just got to sail, you know, the best we can, and that's exactly what we did. We got into that race, we had a good start. Moroni didn't. My own feeling is that we did rattle Moroni a bit, having had that big comeback from mid-fleet all the way back to second in that previous race, and I think that must have destabilised their own confidence and certainly worked to our advantage. And they had a few issues with, as I understand, in having heard at the end of the race, they didn't get their start right. They were about 5 seconds off behind. So in fact, they started about half a boat length behind the pack. And that was probably the end of the race. That simple, you know, mistake there then allowed a lot of the other fleet, which were very keen to do well in their own respective positions, just buried Moroni. The only thing we could do is sail the best we could and see what happened, and that's the rest is history.
Now, a couple of questions coming from that, Guido. First, I got to know John Kostecki fairly well, having covered a few Volvo races in my time. Handy man to have as your tactician.
Yeah, you said it. Well, look, I mean, John has got to be one of the most experienced tacticians in the world. We were very fortunate that he was available and wanted to join us. We really worked hard at making the whole team dynamic work very well, and I think John would agree that it was a really nice environment that we created together on the boat. He's a tough taskmaster, and I don't think anybody would, nor himself, shy away from that, but he certainly brings an amazing discipline and knowledge which we were fortunate enough to be able to build on, and helped improve our own sailing over the couple of weeks that we sailed together, because you might be aware that we had a sprint regatta leading up to the Australian Nationals and then leading to the World. So we had three regattas in a row, and during that time we then built our own team dynamic with John on the boat, which is the first time he'd sailed with us, and it worked very well. I was extremely pleased with it, and John was a great guy for us and enjoyed it thoroughly.
Now, talking of enjoying it thoroughly, did it help, or was it even sweeter, given that this was home waters you were winning the World Championships upon?
Oh, well, absolutely. Firstly, I've been in the Far 40 fleet for just on 4 years now, and after a year of it, and we'd done the Worlds at Porto Cervo in Sardinia in 2009, I said to the boys, my crew, guys, we've got to have a good showing in Sydney. Let's see what we can do. Let's really see if we can get at least on the podium in Sydney as a minimum. And we actually exceeded our own expectations by winning it, and even the year before in the Dominican Republic, coming second in that regatta was, you know, just well beyond my own expectations. But, you know, what it proved to us is it wasn't a fluke that we had the Dominican Republic position as second. Even though it was a small fleet, it certainly had a very top quality group of boats that had come down to the Caribbean, as the Americans say. And I think we're the same as you guys. We say Caribbean, but the Americans say Caribbean.
We'll stick with that.
Yeah. So, you know, we were very chuffed to win it on our own waters. I don't think there was any local knowledge advantage, frankly. I think all of the sailors at the top end of that fleet know how to sail in any waters. And John had never, you know, hadn't sailed in those waters, for example, but it didn't seem to stop him from picking the shifts and picking, you know, where the dynamics were on the race course and taking advantage of it to the best advantage that he could. So, you know, we were very, very, very happy with being able to win it.
Okay, that's it from this, the latest edition of Jibe Talking. I'm Guy Swindles, and we'll be back next time with all the latest from the world of sailing. In the meantime, do remember to check in at regular intervals to the brand new Volvo Ocean Race website at www.volvooceanrace.com.